First of all, this Friends of the Family series has been just a great deal of fun for each of us. She had a chance to explore John Calvin and Luther all together. And then, of course, Mike had a chance to talk about George Frideric Handel. And we even had a little interlude with a concert from the Miami University Glee Club, which was just astounding, I thought. The repertoire they presented to us, amazing music. And then next week, of course, Doug, who is our artist in residence here at National Presbyterian Church. I presume that's show and tell, too. He'll show us some art and tell about this incredible painter, Tanner, that meant so much to him. So I have two more after this, Fanny Crosby, and then, of course, on our last time together before the summer is underway, really, Blaise Pascal. I've had a chance in picking the people I got to choose to choose people that have meant a great deal to me. That's why I call it Friends of the Family, Christians who have marked our lives for good. And that's what we've been able to do, is to look at these Christians that have had that role in our lives. Now today, I have two books that I'm holding up. That there's so many things that have been written on Martin Luther King Jr., but probably one of the most outstanding books is the autobiography of Martin Luther King Jr., and it was edited by Claiborne Carson. It's an absolutely marvelous, it's a unique autobiography. It's a little bit like the book that Eberhard Busch put together for Karl Barth, which is many quotations and it's almost like he's being interviewed by the editor who puts it all together. And it's a wonderful, marvelous book about the life of Martin Luther King. And then the other book is My Life with Martin Luther King Jr. by his wife, Coretta Scott King. Just another beautiful book. I brought them both because some of the readings I want him to speak for himself. So some of the readings are from these two books. Well, one of the great dreamers of the American dream was a Baptist pastor, Martin Luther King Jr. He was born January 15th, 1929. That makes him a contemporary of a great number of us here in this room. I was born in 1931, and a lot of you were born in the 20s or in the 30s, so he's a contemporary of ours. He was born at his parents' home in Atlanta. His father, Martin Luther King Sr., was a huge man, 225 pounds, robust personality, a very strong, kind of a joyous, powerful personality, and a powerful influence in the life of Martin Luther King, his son. His mother, Alberta Williams, was the daughter of a pastor, and Martin Luther King Sr. was the son of a pastor. So there is a long legacy of pastors here. Her father was the pastor of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. So this young man, Martin Luther King Sr., marries Alberta Williams, the daughter of the pastor of the Ebenezer Baptist Church. He then becomes the associate under his father-in-law and becomes a pastor of that great church. And guess what? His son becomes an assistant pastor in that same church. So there's a long legacy in that amazing church in Atlanta. Martin Luther King Jr. died of an assassin's bullet in Memphis on April 4th, 1968, at the age of 39. So in those short years, he had lived an incredible life that we have made a national holiday to honor that life. I want to trace the key events in his remarkable life journey. And I also want us to hear from his own words, too, because that's going to be one of the high points, I think, of this journey we get today. We did that in each of our weeks. We'll do the same thing with Fanny Crosby when we hear her songs. We'll do the same thing with Blaise Pascal when we hear Pascal speak. And we did it with Chesterton as well and Karl Barth. We want to watch these people and listen to what they have to say. So it's not just, I'm trying to just play the role of a biographer. That it wouldn't do it. You've got to hear from himself. He grew up in the shadow of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. His father and his mother both had profound influences upon him. There are two letters that he wrote that are really quite priceless that give you an insight into his relationship with his mother and his father. This one letter was written when he was just a young man starting in his first college stint before he went to Morehouse. He was in a little college up in Connecticut for a while before he went to Morehouse. And in 1944, he wrote this letter, "Dear Father, I am very sorry I am so long about writing. Is that the first line for every kid that ever writes home? But I've been working most of the time. We are really having a fine time here, and the work is very easy. We have to get up every day at 6 o'clock. We have very good food, and I am working kitchen, so you see that I get better food. We have service here every Sunday at 8 o'clock, and I am the religious leader, and we have a boys' choir here, and we're going to sing in the air soon, on the air soon. Sunday I went to church in Simsbury. It's a white church. I could not get to Hartford to church, but I'm going to try next week. On our way here, we saw some things that I had never anticipated to see. After we passed Washington, there was no discrimination at all, and the white people here are very nice. We go to any place we want to go and sit where we want to sit. Tell everybody I said hello, and I am still thinking of the church and reading my Bible. I like that. And I'm not doing anything that I would not do in front of you, your son. I love that. I just love that letter. A little later, he wrote a letter to his mother that is just priceless. When he was now later in college, he wrote this letter to his mother. Actually, when he's now out of college in seminary, but this is such a priceless letter. I wanted to give you this letter to his mother. Dear mother, your letter was received this morning. I often tell the boys around the campus, this is when he was at Crozier. I'll tell you about all his school experience in just a minute. But he said, I always tell the boys around campus that I have the best mother in the world. You will never know, and that's a thing that often kids will write home. And I'm glad that they do write that home too. Not just on Mother's Day, but you will never know how I appreciate the many kind things you and Daddy are doing for me. So far, I've gotten the money, $5, every week. As to my wanting some clippings from the newspapers, I must answer, yes. I wondered why you hadn't sent many, especially from the Atlanta World. He wanted new clippings, evidently, from the Atlanta newspaper. You stated that my letters aren't very newsy. Well, I don't have much news. I never go anywhere except in the books. And sometimes a professor comes to class and tells us to read our assignments in Hebrew. And that is really hard. And then he says, this is not about Coretta, who he met later and fell in love quickly with this beautiful Coretta. But he said, do you know the girl I used to date at Spelman? Well, she's in school at Temple, and I've been to see her twice. Also, I met a fine chick in Philadelphia who has gone wild over the old boy. Since Barber told the members of his church that my family was rich, the girls are running me down. Of course, I don't ever think about them. I'm too busy studying. I hear from Christine every week, and I try to answer her regularly as possible. Well, I guess I must get back to studying and give everybody my regards. Your son, Martin Luther. Well, I just think that was a good insight into this young man in his relationship with his mother and his father. He absolutely adored both his mother and his father. One of the last conversations that Martin Luther King had before he died was with his mother, actually. He called her from Memphis and talked to her. He went to Morehouse College from 1944 to 1948. He sang in the Morehouse Glee Club. I don't know if that means a lot to you. I have heard the Morehouse. How many of you have heard the Morehouse Glee Club? Or that, boy, Dale, you've heard. There is nothing like it. I was in Atlanta once and had a chance to hear this men's glee club. I was just blown away. And he was in that famous Morehouse Glee Club. In fact, they sang at his memorial service. So think of what that meant to his wife, that glee club that he had been in sang for him. And he was in Morehouse. And then he was ordained assistant minister at the Ebenezer. And then from there, after 1948, from 1949 to 1951, he went to Crozier Seminary in Chester, Pennsylvania. While he was there, we see a side of his personality as this young man becomes very inquisitive intellectually. This young man was a first-rate young intellectual. No question about it, because what he had to say and what he wrote at that time, I think is just quite remarkable. I'm going to read some of the things he wrote about his inquiry into worldviews and into philosophies of life. He had a brush with Marxism, in his readings at that time. He said, I strongly disagree with Marxism. Bears critique on it. During the Christmas holidays of 1949, I decided to spend my spare time reading Karl Marx to try to understand the appeal of communism for many people. For the first time, I carefully scrutinized Das Kapital and the Communist Manifesto. I also read some interpretive works on the thinking of Marx and Lenin. In reading much communist writing, I drew certain conclusions that have remained with me as convictions to this day. This is Martin Luther King now reflecting back in his autobiography. First, I rejected their materialistic interpretation of history. Communism, avowedly secularistic and materialistic, has no place for God. This I could never accept, for as a Christian, I believe that there is a creative personal power in the universe, who is the ground and essence of all reality. A power that cannot be explained in materialistic terms. History is ultimately guided by spirit, not matter. I mean, this young man is writing this. This is a thoughtful assessment of the dialectical view of communism and Marxism. It's quite remarkable, I think. Secondly, I strongly disagree with communism's ethical relativism, since for the community there is no divine government or sense of divine governance, no moral, absolute moral authority. There are no fixed, immutable principles. You'll see that these became major points in his later speeches, the sense that he's aware of a sense of moral absolute, of moral truth. Consequently, almost anything, force, violence, murder, lying, is justifiable means to the millennial ends of the communist dream. This type of relativism is abhorrent to me. Constructive ends can never give absolute moral justification to destructive means. Remember when we studied Bonhoeffer earlier, Bonhoeffer made the same observation, that your means... the means you used as a goal will outlast maybe the nod you give to, oh, we're doing all this for world peace. But, of course, we have to murder a few people to get ready for the world peace that we're going to launch. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer rejected it. Here's Martin Luther King rejecting it, too, as a young theologian, philosopher. Thus, a third, I oppose communism's political totalitarianism. In communism, the individual ends up in subjection to the state. True, the Marxists would argue that the state is an interim reality, which is to be eliminated when the class of society emerges. But the state, in the end, but the state is the end while it lasts, and man only a means to that end. And if any man's so-called rights or liberties stand in the way of that end, then they are simply swept aside. His liberties of expression, his freedom to vote, his freedom to listen to what views he wants to listen to, and choose the books he wants to choose, are all restricted. Man becomes hardly more in communism than a depersonalized dog in the turning wheel of the state. These are really remarkable insights from the young theologian Martin Luther King. But then he also is hard on capitalism. He takes a look at American capitalism, and he has also some very telling remarks to make there. He says, capitalism is always in danger of inspiring to men to be more concerned about making a living than making a life. You'll see this comes across reading his great I Have a Dream speech, too. Not just to make a living, you've got to make a life. We are prone to judge success by the index of our salaries or the size of our automobiles, rather than by the quality of our service and our relationship to humanity. Thus, capitalism can lead to a practical materialism that is as pernicious as the materialism taught by communism. It's interesting, isn't it, that he saw that danger in capitalism by itself, too. Then he also had a brush with Nietzsche. And again, while he's a young theologian, he simply had to face up to Nietzsche. Perhaps my faith in love was temporarily shaken by the philosophy of Nietzsche. I had been reading parts of the Genealogy of Morals and the whole of his book, The Will to Power. Nietzsche's glorification of power in his theory, all life expressed the will to power was an outgrowth of his contempt for ordinary mortals. He attacked the whole of the Hebraic Christian morality with its virtues of piety and humility and its otherworldliness and its attitude towards suffering as the glorification of weakness. He really understands Nietzsche. This is a very profound insight into the tragedy and the flaw of Nietzsche. He looked to the development of a superman who would surpass man as man surpassed the ape. But then he had a life-changing experience. One day, one Sunday afternoon, I traveled to Philadelphia to hear a sermon by Dr. Mordecai Johnson, the president of Howard University. Now we're getting a Washington, D.C. Touch in his life. He was there to preach at Fellowship House in Philadelphia. Dr. Johnson had just returned from a trip to India. And to my great interest, he spoke of the life and the teachings of Mahatma Gandhi. His message was so profound and so electrifying that I left the meeting and bought a half dozen books on Gandhi's life and works. And then he goes on to say that it was this truth force teaching in Gandhi. As you know, Gandhi was very much influenced by our Lord's Sermon on the Mount. Did you know that when Gandhi was in London, he went to hear Spurgeon preach every Sunday? He almost became a Christian. He didn't. But he was terribly impressed with the Sermon on the Mount and terribly impressed with the truth force teaching of Jesus Christ. And this obviously had a profound influence on Martin Luther King. In fact, in his biography, isn't it interesting, he's standing here and a picture of Gandhi is on the wall. And later in the autobiography, he spends quite a bit of time telling of his trip to India. He met Pandit Nehru. He also wanted to study the work of Gandhi with his truth force and nonviolent approach to social change. So that became one of the great influences. I looked at the influences in his life, and I think theologically, the influence of Mordecai Johnson, and then when he went on to Boston University, two professors at Boston University, one of whom spoke at his memorial service, but two professors played a key, a healthy role in the shaping of his theology and the shaping of his outlook on life. It's interesting. I love this. He says, theologically, I find myself still holding to the liberal position. I had come to see, this is when he went first to Boston University, he said, I found myself holding that position. When I had come to see more than ever before, there were certain enduring qualities in liberalism, which all of the vociferous noises of fundamentalism could never destroy. However, while in Boston, I became much more sympathetic toward the new orthodox position. You know who that is, Karl Barth, my hero. In other words, he became under the influence of the new orthodoxy. That's what, when Karl Barth is described, he's often described as the father of neo-orthodoxy, new orthodoxy, a return to orthodoxy. And I'm so glad that that happened in Martin Luther King's life. I did see it as a necessary corrective for a liberalism that had become too shallow and was too easily capitulated to modern culture. Again, a profound insight into one of the weaknesses of a lot of the religious systems that we see today that are so easily co-opted by what is the cultural motif. And by the way, in the middle of all this, he tells about his encounter with Reinhold Niebuhr and the influence of Niebuhr. But it's interesting, he had a problem with Niebuhr, the same problem I had with Niebuhr. And the same problem that John Mackay had with Niebuhr. Niebuhr was tremendous, moral man, immoral society. And Niebuhr helped Martin Luther King see the raw sinfulness of man. That man, and that this, of course, is what brought him more to the new orthodoxy. The raw sinfulness of man was really featured by Niebuhr. And that was important for this young man, Martin Luther King. He's under the influence of the two great professors, Dr. Harold DeWolf and Dr. Brightman. These two men at Boston University played a key role in shaping Martin Luther King. plus this new orthodoxy, plus Reinhold Niebuhr, who helped him see that you have to face up to the sinfulness of man. Which, the reason I'm bringing all these out is, when you now later are going to hear his speeches, you're going to hear a man who's not a blind idealist. He does have a dream. And I'm going to let him speak for himself when you'll see that dream. But there's a realism in Martin Luther King, and I think we have to owe a debt to these influences. His father, with the warm evangelicalism of his father and mother, his steady and marvelous wife, his influence of these two professors at Boston University, and of course the influence of Gandhi, great influence of truth force coming from that part of the world into this man's life, and then Niebuhr's realism, but the gospel's power. In fact, at one point he says his problem with Niebuhr was that Niebuhr is so, Niebuhr was so convinced of the sinfulness of man that he wasn't sure even God could do anything about it. And Martin Luther King could not buy that. He could not buy that we were irredeemable, that we were so sinful that God could do something about it. And he believed in that, and I believe that is the dream that comes out in his speeches. So, there's the man and his education. He finished Crozier in 1951. He went to Boston University and worked on a PhD at Boston University. Came under the influence of these other two men, DeWolf and Brightman, and draws up his life goal. Now, here is the way he describes sort of his life goal that he shaped when he was at Boston University. The thing we need in the world today is a group of men and women who will stand up and fight, stand up for right, and be opposed to wrong wherever it is. A group of people who have come, he wrote this as a kind of a manifesto for himself, who come to see that some things are wrong. See, again, that's the influence of Niebuhr. Niebuhr said, yeah, there are some things that are wrong that you have to face up to. Whether they are never caught up with, some things are right, whether nobody sees that you're doing them or not. Remember, like he says to his dad, I would do anything, I couldn't do it in front of you. All I'm trying to say is our world hinges on moral foundations. God has made it so. God has made the universe to be based on moral law. And you cannot make sense out of Martin Luther King apart from that. He has that, which the modern relativists don't have that. He has that wonderful anchor. And I see it in every single one of his speeches. The universe hinges on moral foundations. There is something in the universe that justifies Carlyle in saying, no lie can live forever. There is something in this universe that justifies William Cullen Bryant in saying, truth crushed, the earth will rise again. There is something in the universe that justifies James Russell Lowell in saying, remember the great song once to every man in nations, truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne, with that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown stands God, within the shadow keeping watch above his own. There is, remember that great hymn? Once to every man in nations is the moment to decide. And there's that one stanza where James Russell Lowell says, even though the scaffold, truth is on the scaffold, and it's being slain, and wrong is on the throne, yet that scaffold sways the future. Great line from James Russell Lowell. And now Martin Luther King he's claiming that line. Notice the role of poetry and music and songs that play in his life. One of the last things he said before he was shot in Memphis was, he was shouting down because they were going to get ready for a rally. He said, be sure she sings, Precious Lord, Take My Hand. He wanted that song sung. And Mahalia Jackson sang that song at his memorial service. Precious Lord, Take My Hand. He loved songs. And he loved these poems. And notice he's quoting them now. There is something in the universe that justifies the biblical writer who says, you shall reap what you sow. As a young man with most of my life ahead of me, I decided early to give my life to something eternal and absolute, not to those little gods that are here today and gone tomorrow, but to God, who is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And of course, that line is in the book of Hebrews about our Lord Jesus Christ. I am not going to put my ultimate faith in the little gods that can be destroyed in an atomic age, but the God who has been our help in ages past and our hope for years to come. And that song by Isaac Watts, "O God, Our Help in Ages Past," was sung at his memorial service as well. By the way, I love that song. That's the hymn of the University of California, Berkeley. My school has a hymn, "O God, Our Help in Ages Past, Our Hope for Years to Come." Okay. I don't know if they know it, but that's the school hymn of the University of California. The University of California, no one knows this, but the Berkeley campus, the University of California, my school, was founded by Henry Durant, a Presbyterian minister. A Presbyterian minister founded the University of California. A lot of people would like to forget that, but it's still the truth. And not as lofty a beginning as some of the Ivy League schools, but at least one Presbyterian minister of frontier Presbyterian minister. You know, the Presbyterian ministers in California were rugged. McAllister was a Presbyterian minister. Durant was a Presbyterian minister. And there's a famous story of McAllister preaching during the gold rush in San Francisco. And there were these troublemakers that were bothering him in the back of the church. And so he went up to preach one day, and he took his six-shooter and put it on the pulpit and said, "Nobody's going to interrupt me today in my sermon." And that's a Presbyterian minister in the rough days of California. Schwarzenegger would love to do this right now with the state of California. Okay. So now let me finish what he says, because this is a wonderful manifesto that this young man wrote about himself. He said, "I'm not going to put my ultimate faith in little gods that can be destroyed in an atomic age, but the God who has been our help in ages past, our hope for years to come, our shelter in the time of storm, and our eternal home. That's the God I'm putting my ultimate faith in. The God that I'm..." See, notice he just weaves poetry into everything he says. And of course, he did that in I Have a Dream speech in Lincoln Memorial. He said that when he began, he had it all written out because the press wanted an advance copy. And two-thirds of the way through, he remembered that he had said in a speech before, "I have a dream," and he threw all that in without script. The greatest part of the speech was without script. And so the press are sitting there trying to figure out, where is the speech going? And because he just, all of that came to him, he said. He had given that speech a few days before, "I have a dream." And he said, "And I have a dream." And all that poetry and everything just came flowing out of this guy. And I'll read that to you in a minute, because that's so exciting. It gives you goosebumps. So the God I'm talking about this morning is the God of the universe and the God who will last through all the ages. If we are to go forward this morning, we've got to go back and find that God. That is the God that demands and commands our ultimate allegiance. And if we go forward, we must go back and rediscover those precious values, that all reality hinges on moral foundations, and all reality has a spiritual control. That is a very great guideline to understanding the speeches that are going to later come. Well, then he met a beautiful girl, and that is Coretta. She's the next chapter in his autobiography. He met her and fell in love. And it was sort of love at first sight. And they were married June 18th, 1953, and they had four children, two boys, two girls. Then his career began with the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. They called him to be pastor. So he's no longer at Ebenezer. He finally got out from under his dad at Ebenezer, but that's not bad. I mean, he now had to be launched on his own. So he's at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, Montgomery. And then everything changes. He gets there, you know, after he gets married and goes there, gets settled in, and Rosa Parks is arrested December 1, 1955. And that's the beginning of the rest of the story in Montgomery, Alabama. Rosa Parks. She was at his memorial service too. Rosa Parks. I think she just died a few months ago at 90 some years old. That's when he met up with his lifelong friend, Ralph Abernathy, who was also a Baptist minister. And they formed and became the founders of the Southern Christian Leadership Council. And they decided to sponsor a boycott. As a result, his house was burned by white terrorists. We assume they were white terrorists that in that town that were so upset. January 30th, 1956, they bombed his home. Everybody was safe, though. No one got hurt, but it was a terrible thing. And then the Supreme Court ruled November 13th, 1956, that against discrimination. So that ended the discrimination in buses. And then with that success, I can't go through every single one, because I want his speeches to come in a minute. I can't go through all of the career that this young pastor had from then on. But the big one that we need to really understand, which becomes so fundamental for the shaping of Martin Luther King, was that after the success of the boycott, they had a boycott. So a peaceful boycott at when Rosa was arrested, and it paid off. And then, of course, they had a Supreme Court ruling that paid off. But then a pastor at the Bethel Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, his house was burned, and his church was burned. And Condoleezza Rice was in Birmingham during that time and was fully aware and lived through that. So she becomes a contemporary of that part of Martin Luther King's life, as does Andrew Young, who became the ambassador of the United Nations, became a player and a friend of Martin Luther King at that time, too. But this Pastor Shuttleworth was arrested. His house was burned. Martin Luther King decided with his friend Ralph Abernathy and other Christians and pastors that we've got to go to Birmingham, and we have got to stage a protest in Birmingham because a commissioner of public safety named Eugene Bull Connor said, "I know how to take care of blacks." And he was had a kind of a reign of terror in Birmingham, Alabama. And they were, it was a very, very dangerous place, and there was a lot of dangerous things were happening. And so they decided that they were going to have, again, a peaceful protest. And they would boycott the shopkeepers and the white stores. Again, peaceful boycott. And then city, the mayor and the city, went to court and got a court injunction against that boycott. Are we all together on that? And they decided to defy that injunction because Martin Luther King felt, and he wrote a lot about that, that it was an unconstitutional injunction. Even though a court had done it, that people can peacefully boycott. To say you can't boycott stores, that's a peaceful boycott. And so they got an injunction to stop the boycott. Martin Luther King now he called this Project C. He had moved really to Birmingham, and he lived in a motel. By the way, the motel room he lived in was bombed. They thought he was there, but he was not there at the time, thank God. But and this man, Eugene Bull Connor, in fairness to the people of Birmingham, they had thrown him out of office. He actually lost the election for mayor. Yet he said, "But I'm still in office for two more years." And so he defied and stayed as the head of public safety and the one that was had all the police dogs and the water hoses and all that he was going to use to break up the boycott. And several amazing things happened. In one case, Martin Luther King tells about it in his autobiography. In one case, even his own guys that he had assembled that were doing these terrible things were going to spray on the there was a group of people praying, and they were going to turn the hose on them, and they had dogs there. And this is when Martin Luther King was put in jail. I'll tell you about that in a minute. And they stayed up, and they stood and prayed. And Bull Connor, that was his last big act before he finally is done in. And he's going to have his guys, going to really show these guys, going to have them spray water on all of them. And the dogs are right there being held at leash. And these folks that were praying just moved toward these officers. And the officers that were going to spray them just simply drifted away. They defied Bull Connor and would not do it. They wouldn't turn the hoses on these folks that were just praying. So that was a great moment. And he tells about that moment. It was one of those great moments that happened, but for which we're grateful. But Martin Luther King was put in jail. He was put in the Birmingham jail, and he got a letter. And we're kind of grateful for that letter now, because as a result of that letter, we get a great letter. He got a letter from the white pastors. This is not a high water mark for the white pastors of Birmingham. But the white pastors of Birmingham wrote a letter to Martin Luther King and said, end the boycott. It's causing more trouble than anything. You've got to stop the boycott. For the sake of the peace, unity, and purity of the church, and all the things they said to try to get him to stop the boycott. And then in the jail, Martin Luther King wrote a letter. I wish I could read the entire letter. He wrote it April 16th, 1963. It's, "My Dear Fellow Clergyman," and it's the letter from a Birmingham jail. The whole letter is in his autobiography. It's one of the most famous things in the history of the Martin Luther King literature. While confined here in the... I'll just read the beginning and the end of it, because this it's pages long. In fact, at the end, he apologizes for, "I'm sorry this letter is so long. You forced me into it. Why I had to write such a long letter." While confined here in the Birmingham City Jail, I came across your recent statement calling my present activities unwise and untimely. Seldom do I pause to answer criticism of my work and ideas. If I sought to answer all the criticisms that crossed my desk, he said, I wouldn't have time to do it all. I think I should indicate why I'm here in the Birmingham, since you have been influenced by your view, which argues against, quote, outsiders coming in. See, that's what they said. You're an outsider coming in, and you're stirring up the people. I have the honor of serving as president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, an organization that's operating in every southern state. So he says, we have come, and then he says, we're affiliated, and that's why I'm here. But more basically, I am in Birmingham because injustice is here. Isn't that a great line? Remember all the things he said in his manifesto. You're now seeing them come out. I'm in Birmingham because injustice is here. Just as the prophets of the 8th century B.C. left their villages and carried their "Thus saith the Lord" far beyond the boundaries of their hometowns. I love biblical expositors. And just as the Apostle Paul left his village of Tarsus and carried the gospel of Jesus Christ to the far corners of the Greco-Roman world, so I'm compelled to carry the gospel of freedom beyond my own hometown. Like Paul, I must constantly respond to the Macedonian call for help. Wow. That was such a great beginning to that letter. And I wish I could read the whole letter to you, but I'm going to read just one more part of that letter. You have to read the letter from the Birmingham jail. But he says here, I've tried to stand between two forces, saying that we need to emulate either the do-nothingness of the complacent or the hatred and despair of the black nationalists. For there is a more excellent way of love and nonviolent protest. I am grateful to God that through the influence of the Negro church, the way of nonviolence became an integral part of our struggle. And the greatness of the letter from the Birmingham jail is that he explains his whole strategy of nonviolent truth force a way of influencing history. If this philosophy had not emerged by now, many streets of the South would, I'm convinced, be flowing with blood. And I am further convinced that if our white brothers dismiss as rabble-rousers and outside agitators those of us who employ nonviolent direct action, and if they refuse to support our nonviolent efforts, then millions of Negroes will, out of frustration and despair, seek solace and security in black nationalist ideologies, a development that would inevitably lead to a frightening racial nightmare. Oppressed people cannot remain oppressed forever. The yearning for freedom eventually manifests itself, and that is what is happening to the American Negro. Something within has reminded him of his birthright of freedom, and something without has reminded him that it can be gained. Isn't that beautiful? The idea that, remember, he believed that God could change. Things could happen. And that comes out in this, that wonderful, that's just marvelous then I'll read some of this stuff at the very end of the letter. So I said, never before have I written so long a letter. I'm afraid it is much too long to take your precious time. I can assure you that it would have been much shorter if I had been writing from a more comfortable desk. But what else can you do when you're alone in a narrow jail cell but write long letters, think long thoughts, and pray long prayers? I love that. If I've said anything in this letter that overstates the truth and indicates an unreasonable impatience, I beg you to forgive me. If I've said anything that understates the truth and indicates my having a patience that allows me to settle for anything less than brotherhood, I beg God to forgive me. Isn't that great? I hope the letter finds you strong in faith. I also hope that circumstances will soon make it possible for me to meet each of you, not as an integrationist or civil rights leader, but as a fellow clergyman and a Christian brother. Let us all hope that the dark clouds of racial prejudice will soon pass away, and the deep fog of misunderstanding will be lifted from our far fear-drenched communities. And in some not too distant tomorrow, the radiant stars of love and brotherhood will shine over our great nation with all the scintillating beauty. Yours for the cause of peace and brotherhood, Martin Luther King, Jr. That's the letter from a Birmingham jail. It's worth getting this whole book just to be able to read that incredible letter, because that's where he really stakes out his entire philosophy, which I think is so incredibly important. Well, August 28th, this was April 16th, 1963. August 28th, 1963 is the day Washington, D.C. will not forget, because there was to be a march for employment, an employment march, that was going to be held at the Lincoln Memorial. And Martin Luther King was asked to give remarks at that march of folks who were going to be in front of the Lincoln Memorial. And I told you what he said in his that when he was very worried about that speech. He was up till 3 in the morning working on that speech. I started out reading the speech, and I read it to a point. The audience response was wonderful that day, and all of a sudden this thing came to me. The previous June, following a peaceful assembly of thousands of people to the streets of downtown Detroit, I delivered a speech in Cobo Hall in which I used the phrase, I have a dream. I had used it before, and I just felt that I wanted to use it here. I don't know why. I hadn't thought about it before the speech. I used the phrase, and at that point I just turned aside from the manuscript altogether and didn't come back to it. And we're grateful. Here's the speech. We won't read the whole speech, but it started out, of course, I am happy to join you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. And then he starts out and says how he gives history of what's happened what's happened. It would be I will give you some of where he plays the role of prophet here. He said, We have come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drugs of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksand of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summer of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until there is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But there is something I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold that leads into a palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Now he decides to be a prophet to his own fellow workers. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protest to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. It's almost, again, borrowing that from Gandhi, that tremendous, and also the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is tied up with our destiny. They have come to realize that their freedom is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. And as we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. So this is a very marvelous. He says, I'm not unmindful that many of you come here out of great trials and tribulation. Some of you come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution, staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Again, he's borrowing that again from the gospel. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of the northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friends, so even though we face difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream. And this is the part that he didn't have in his script, that he simply got carried away. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will someday live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day down in Alabama, with its vicious races, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and little girls, black girls, will be able to join hands with little white boys and little white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley will be exalted. Now he's quoting in the Bible again. Every hill and mountain will be made low. The rough places will be made plain. The crooked places will be made straight. The glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh will see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I will go back to the south with. This is the faith we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair, a stone of hope. With this faith, we'll be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this dream, we'll be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we'll be free one day. This will be the day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers die, land of the pilgrim's pride, from every mountainside let freedom ring." And if America is to be a great nation, that must become true. So let freedom ring from the prestigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain, Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi. Every mountainside, let freedom ring. And when this happens, when we allow freedom to ring, we will let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city. We'll be able to speed up that day when all God's children, black men, white men, Jews, Gentiles, Protestants, Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, thank God, Almighty, we are free at last. That was his speech. Then in April 4th of 1968, of course he got the Nobel Prize for Peace. He continued tremendous ministry that continued from there on. And the Southern Leadership Council, all those things that he did with Ralph Abernathy. And then, of course, April 4th, 1968, he was assassinated. Coretta tells about the service that honored him. And I don't know, I just thought I would just read that. It's so touching. It was a short service, but very beautiful. There were readings from the Old Testament, New Testament, a prayer, short tribute, excerpts from some of his own sermons, and music. We had chosen his favorite hymns, and these are his favorite hymns. "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross," "In Christ There Is No East or West," and these were followed by special favorites of Martin's, "Softly and Tenderly," and then appropriately to his whole life, "Where He Leads, I Will Follow." The choir of Ebenezer sang more beautifully and movingly than I've ever heard them. And then, of course, they sang two more songs, "I Trust in God, If I Can Help." Then the tribute was given by Dr. DeWolf, his great friend. And then they went and marched over to Morehouse College. And at Morehouse College, the choir sang, "O God, Our Help in Ages Past." And Mahalia Jackson sang, "Precious Lord, Take My Hand." That's the man.